Yeah, Anatoly asked me when I arrived, what do you think about relativistic shocks? And postpone my answer for today. And this is, so we'll talk about some recent work I did with, I've done with Martin Lemoine, my main collaborator on these topics. Martin Lemoine is in Institut d'Astrophysique de Paris. Usually he is, yeah, he shares his time between primordial cosmology and that kind of research. So. So at the beginning of this century, the people were quite optimistic with relativistic shocks and Fermi acceleration at in relativistic regimes, and expected to get with relativistic shock better performances than with non-relativistic shocks, and maybe also explain the generation of ultra-high energy cosmic rays thanks to relativistic shocks. But I think the mind of people changed recently, and so I will see why. So in non-relativistic regime, when particles undergo Fermi cycles, at each cycle they gain just a little amount of energy, but they are doing that many times, many times. So they can reach a lot of energy. In relativistic shocks, the energy gain is much larger. It's a sizable number. It's close to 2 after the first shock. When at the first shock, when you measure the energy gain upstream, in the upstream flow, the gain is even by a gamma, factor gamma square. But then, as had been shown by Yves Galland and Bram Achterberg, you have only gain of order 2, but which is quite significant. But which only few cycles, much less than in non-relativistic shocks. So in both cases, the theory can be done within a Markovian description of the, but not with Fokker-Planck in description in non-relativistic case, but Fokker-Planck equation. Excuse me. Yeah. But not Fokker-Planck in a relativistic regime. So that's a technical aspect of the things. In non-relativistic shocks, particles can scatter over large scale. They can diffuse at long distance from the shocks upstream, whereas particles are rapidly caught up by the shock upstream. When the momentum is deviated by an angle of order 1 over gamma s, and so they are stick to the shock upstream. And yeah, they are caught up over a length of order, a Larmor radius measured in the front frame. Whereas distribution functions are almost isotropic in the non-relativistic case, but not completely. There is always some remaining anisotropy responsible for instabilities. In relativistic regime, the distribution function is very anisotropic because of these properties of being caught up, so with a small deflection. And the hope was that we have large gain in relativistic regime, and the acceleration process is much faster than in non-relativistic regime, where the acceleration time is larger than the scattering time, which is generally, depending on the rigidity of the particles, much longer than the Larmor time, whereas in a relativistic regime we can have acceleration time comparable to the Larmor time. The last point will be the important issue for we'll talk about. Whereas in non-relativistic shocks, magnetic field are often quasi-parallel, I would say more precisely subliminal. It can be very oblique, but still subliminal, because as long as the sine of the angle of the magnetic field respect to normal sinus is smaller than 1, whereas the generic case in relativistic regime, for relativistic shocks, is to have Lorentz factor of the shock times the sinus of the inclination angle larger than one, which puts the regime of the shock in the superluminal case. So this will be the origin of many difficulties. I'll try to sketch rapidly what we can think about the structure of collisionless shocks. Collisionless because the all the characteristic size of the shocks, precursor, shock widths, and so on, are very smaller than the mean free path of the particles. Actually, the first case is probably the most tricky, the most difficult conceptually, the case where the magnetic field is in subluminal configuration, or when you have no magnetic field at all. All the collisionless shocks are set up with some amount of reflected particles. Some incoming particles are reflected back, and this will be at the origin of the formation of the collisionless shock itself. In this case, there is no other understanding of the formation of this shock structure than generation of turbulence by reflected particles in a self-consistent way. The particles start to be reflected and then trigger instabilities, and the gradient of the growing modes generate a ponderable motive force that participate to the reflection of the particles. That's what can be seen in the Anatoly simulations with viable modes. If you have a magnetized electron-positron plasma, the situation is quite simple. You have a setup of a magnetic barrier that reflected back a significant fraction of incoming particles. But if you have electron protons in the supernominal case, so this is the most frequent situation, you have two agents of reflection. You have a magnetic barrier, but which is supplemented by a potential electrostatic potential barrier. And it can easily be understood with if you consider electron in a quasi Boltzmann equilibrium, once the particle reach a temperature comparable to the incoming energy of protons, you have a potential drop that will be of the same order of magnitude and capable to reflect a sizable fraction of incoming particle. So there are three important ingredients in such a shock structure. You have a ramp, it means the field, magnetic field, and the potential, electrostatic potential, are increasing suddenly. There is actually a strong current, transverse current, associated to this sharp ramp, which is governed by collisionless resistivity and some effective resistivity that develop over a narrow sheet of order the inertial length of electrons. So this is the effective resistivity effect that is responsible also for the overshoot, the potential arise, and also the magnetic field rise to a value larger than the equilibrium value that we will take downstream. And of course, this controls also the amount of reflected particles at the shock. And you have a much larger a much larger scale, which is the scale of what we call the foot, where the particles are reflected. But because you have a transverse magnetic field and an electric field of convection associated with this transverse magnetic field, in the front frame, particles undergo cycloidal motions and gain energy in the electric field, and enough energy to then, after some travel some over this distance, which is a kind of Larmor radius measured in the frame of this front, this particle then eventually cross the barrier and come in the downstream flow. In non-relativistic superluminal shocks, electron temperature even becomes larger than proton temperature, because you have two kind supplementary heating process for electron, which is the anomalous Joule effect that makes the electron temperature higher. And at relativistic shocks, because this energy is considerable for electrons, they probably lose a tremendous amount of energy by irradiation. So I don't know exactly at which temperature they are stabilized. So the big problem will be the scattering issue in such superluminal. Yeah, but not first day. Yeah, so the scattering issue is subluminal configurations is not a problem. That works quite well. So in subluminal configuration, it's easy because the particles that come back from downstream to upstream comes back with a momentum in this cone of opening angle 1 over gamma s. And the mean field is within this cone. So you have a significant fraction, can be estimated by this number, a significant fraction of particles that comes back along the mean field and can travel at long distances. And these beams of particles generate micro instabilities that will be responsible for scattering. And this precursor length will be limited actually by the turbulent scattering generated self-consistently by these reflecting particles. And so the length of the precursor will depend on the intensity of the scattering waves. This fixes also the gradient and efficiency of the gradient that is capable to reflect some amount of incoming particles. So you have a self-generation of electromagnetic turbulence thanks to the very anisotropic streaming generated by this very anisotropic streaming. You have an efficient generation of instabilities of mostly these three types of instability: beam plasma type, with a non-resonant regime of vibrant instabilities that generate current filaments transverse to the along the beam, and the oblique two-stream instability, which is a resonant interaction between the beams and the plasma waves, but which is mostly electrostatic, but with some amount of transverse component also, but mostly electrostatic. And because the extension of the precursor is quite long, you can even excite MHD type instability, like the Bell instability, whose current of the generated by the flow of this charged particle generate uncompressible MHD waves. So this is the case where the peak simulation develop a lot and give very interesting results these last years, during these last years, and many people now starting, and many people in the audience are involved in these peak simulations. In France, we have a master of peak simulation whose name is Bertrand Lambège, and we started the collaboration with him, but essentially to try to investigate the superluminal case where the scattering issue is quite difficult. So in superluminal case, so for simplicity, you can even imagine that the magnetic field is almost exactly transverse to the flow. So along the plane of the shock. If we look first at the motion of particles in the precursor, so you have a I sketch here, I drew the Larmor circle. And in blue, you have the shock front, which is moving towards the right. So you have here a particle that penetrates from downstream to upstream, and that undergo a simple Larmor motions, and then it catches up by the, it's caught up by the shock that progresses at velocity beta s. And this travel is even shorter than a Larmor radius measured in the front frame. But it's even worse, more frightening if you measure it in the upstream co-moving frame, because you have not only a division by gamma s, by the Lorentz factor, but also you have to look at just the difference between the position of the particle and the position of the shock, which is moving at beta s. So instead of having a division by gamma s, you have a gamma s cube denominator. So it means that the penetration of the particle upstream is very short. It's even not, it can be, it can still be an MHD scale, because of course you have a gamma square and the energy in the Larmor radius. Mm-hmm. But it's nevertheless divided by gamma s. So it's a kind of Larmor radius of protons at low energy divided by gamma s. It's quite short. Anyway, if the ambient plasma has a low magnetization, so such that the alpha n velocity times gamma s is smaller than 1, which is the case in the interstellar medium if you consider a terminal shock wave from a gamma ray burst, for instance, we are in this regime, that size is still in MHD. An MHD range. But any MHD modes will have a growth rate smaller than the cyclotron, proton cyclotron pulsation. Yeah? And it will be impossible for MHD wave to grow during this short penetration. It's too short. This is in an upstream frame, in the co-moving upstream frame of the plasma, where you see the shock front coming towards you. And yeah. Yes, in shock frame, this is the, you have the Larmor radius in, but you have to take into account the change also in the intensity of the magnetic field and so on. So it's not a simple change of scale as in usual relativity. We are still inside the foot of the shock. That's true. Yeah, but not. What I consider as the width of the shock is the narrow round. But yeah, all the particles there are still, for the first Fermi cycle, it will be the same. For these reflected particles and for first Fermi cycle, the particles are inside the foot of the shock. So we have to generate turbulence intensively inside the foot of the shock in order to and the hope of seeing something develop for Fermi acceleration.
Yeah. No matter what. Yeah. If it goes back from downstream to upstream. So it looks to me that the most critical part is to go
yeah.
from downstream to upstream.
Exactly. But the problem is that, I will come to that later, but upstream or the foot of the shock is the only place where we can generate turbulence that could be transmitted downstream and hello, particles scattering downstream for particles to come back from downstream to upstream. Now, if they are not scattered upstream, doesn't matter because they will come back.
But maybe downstream can generate other types of turbulence.
Maybe, but it was not completely clear. I was looking for that, yes. But for the moment, I found only possibilities of triggering the type of turbulence we need just from these short penetration upstream, and it has transmitted then downstream. Mm. So only micro turbulence generated by kinetic instabilities can be expected in this foot of the shock and may scatter particle on the scale. I said may because I'm not sure that will be effective, and maybe we will not need, but we will need generation of micro turbulence anyway, if we want to have a Fermi process. However, yeah, when a precursor has been developed by micro turbulence on larger scale, then it means at scale, you accelerate, imagine that you accelerate particles, then the scattering of particles of Larmor radius larger than the coherence lengths of the magnetic fluctuations diffuse over such kind of lengths, Larmor radius to the square over coherence lengths of the electromagnetic perturbation. Then, if it extends sufficiently over larger scale than the scale of the foot, we may expect also MHD instabilities that could grow on a time scale shorter than the convection time. Now the scattering issue downstream is almost or a little less difficult, but is still severe. So simply, if you consider particles that penetrate downstream from upstream, this is the shock, so the particle is coming there, then it will undergo, if you have no scattering effect, a Larmor trajectory while the shock front probe is advancing toward the right, and then could be able to come back upstream. Except, so it's unavoidable for any particle starting from all that part of the Larmor circle, except the red, that red interval. For particle coming from that red interval, when it goes over this Larmor trajectory, the shock passed away. It's impossible to come back upstream. The important point, and when particles can come back upstream because they started somewhere here in this part of the circle, they come back in this no return interval. It can be demonstrated. So any particle cannot make more than 1.5 Fermi cycle, except if there is a tremendous scattering effect in the downstream region. So three times shock crossing is the maximum that the particle can do because of the transverse main field. And so particles are then eventually entrained in the downstream flow by the magnetic field. So to prevent this is true if you introduce scattering such that the scattering times is longer than Larmor time, you will not be able to avoid this entrainment of particle downstream. And this is only when you have a fast scattering process at a time scale shorter than the Larmor time that this will be possible to detrap particles in order that can come back upstream. Such kind of trapping of detrapping of scattering, this regime of scattering cannot be met in MHD theory. That's necessarily, it requires non-MHD condition with very intense small scale fluctuation and with a different scattering law than what we are familiar with in a turbulent, in MHD turbulence. And the excitation of such microturbulence can be done upstream unless you have some trick to generate intense short scale turbulence downstream directly without considering the upstream penetration. I will offer you a bottle of champagne if you have some, if you have possibility to to generate intense microturbulence without considering the anisotropic effect upstream. So we expect to excite microturbulence thanks to the strong anisotropy upstream, and then this is a second problem. It's not automatic that this microturbulence is transferred downstream. It turns out that the scattering conditions are more easily fulfilled downstream than upstream, and so if we succeed to generate Fermi cycles thanks to microturbulence, this will be a Fermi cycle of an hybrid type. This will be semi-diffusive downstream and of semi-drift upstream. All the time, the scattering time that we found through microturbulence theory are times or scattering time that increase with energy faster than the Larmor time. It means that beyond some energy, anyway, we will be again in these trapping conditions. It means that we will be able to make a Fermi process to be operative only in some energy interval, and then we have an intrinsic cutoff. That explained by energy loss. This is a point I will develop during the conference. I will not say more today. Yeah, these are numerical Monte Carlo simulations of this process of particle coming back and forth in it. First, in organized field, transverse organized field, particles, this is a phase space, that's the velocity multiplied by the Bolt-Lorentz factor of the shock in order to increase the map. This is a kind of Poincaré map in the plane of the shock. And particles that come from downstream to upstream comes into this green region. And in order to have a further Fermi cycle, we should expect them to come back in this blue, hell blue region. And unfortunately, they come back by the red part, which means that they will not come back. And in this diagram, this is the same, but with simply Kolmogorov turbulence. So we see that in a Kolmogorov turbulence, where you have coherence scale concentrated at large scale, it behaves like an organized field, and particles undergo this self kind of phase portrait. So we definitely need to consider a very different type of turbulence. And this has been also independently seen by simulation by Niemec, Pohl, and Ostrovsky, more or less at the same time as us independently. But they did not analyze the phase portraits of particles, but they came to the same conclusion. So that cannot be ordinary turbulence. You need very intense turbulence at short scale. Intense in the sense that delta B over B might be much larger than one. Even it depends on energy. It could be even worse than that. And on that scale, as measured in the upstream frame. So can we expect which kind of microturbulence excitation can we expect in upstream, in superluminal configuration? In non-relativistic case, the major instabilities that generate microturbulence in the foot of the shock is what we call the modified two-stream instabilities. It's it's an instability which is triggered by a current motion of particles, but not a beam. It's a cycloid. So in front frame, it's a cycloid. So calculations are not very easy. But the ultra-relativistic case is very interesting, because if you look at this problem in the upstream co-moving frame, first, you have no cycloid, it's a normal circle, because you have no electric field in this frame. And also, you see just a small portion of a circle that you can assimilate to just a linear trajectory, a small linear trajectory. So you have almost a linear beam pervading the ambient plasma. That's very comfortable. And because of this short time, the particle had no time to be magnetized in the beam. So you are considering a linear beam of unmagnetized particle. That's very pleasant. Now the nature of the instabilities will depend essentially on the magnetization of the ambient particles, electrons, protons. And you will find again two kinds of instability, non-resonant interaction, the Weber instability, and also unusual resonant interaction with the magnetic mode in a transverse field. Usually you have resonant interaction either at Larmor, at synchrotron resonance, but not that kind of Cherenkov resonance transverse to a field. So it's a very unusual situation and very interesting. So you have quasi-Cherenkov resonance transverse to a field with mode which can be also magnetized. So let's see first the situation of the excitation of microinstability with a mean field for an electron proton plasma. Yeah, this is not my preferred definition of magnetization, but so this is the magnetization parameter for the ambient magnetic field and ambient density rho upstream, in the upstream co-moving frame. This is different than magnetization used by Anatoly and Lorenzo. Yeah. Yeah. You have your wall and the front, which is moving apart from the hole. And this is the upstream flow, right? And we look at the magnetization in the proper frame of the ambient medium. And that magnetization here, we can also call it sigma U, is different from the magnetization that you measured here. Yeah, that's right. That's the problem is when we look at the critical conditions, where the inclination is small over the one of the gamma. So there is a gamma square in that case, in between both. Mm. And so it depends also on the fraction of particles that are in the of reflected particles in a more general in the wide sense, or all the particles that participate to a possibility of a Fermi cycle or that are reflected back. So in this frame, X is a measure of the Lorentz factor. And somehow we can say that Y is a measure of the magnetization, but with some this conversion parameter in the definition of Y and gamma S square. J is just somehow a numerical factor larger than one, but much, very much, not much larger than one. So actually, for a bulk Lorentz factor smaller than 800, you are in this interval, which is mostly the case. This is all the realistic case are in that interval. And then you can see that you can trigger Wiesler instabilities when the magnetization goes below some critical value. That critical value is here. It's sigma, the conversion parameter times mass ratio divided by Lorentz factor to the cube. Actually, for the excitation of resonant excitation, the temperature has no significant effect. Actually, we can have, of course, transversely, the particles of the beam are cold, very cold. There's no very small dispersion of a 1 over gamma transverse to the flow. But you can have a large dispersion along the flow. But for resonant interaction, it concerns only velocity, not momentum. Background electrons are supposed to be cold. Yeah, so if we redo the calculation, assuming that electrons are progressively heated in the foot, that it will change the result, yeah. Hot before this, the ramp? Okay, we have to continue to develop more sophisticated calculation. But
can I just say that if MP is equal to MP,
Yeah. Wouldn't
that be the regime of quasi
electron? Oh, yeah. Yes, true. Yeah, that's fine. Yes. In pair plasma, this is that part of the graph which is relevant. Yeah. I have prepared a slide for electron positron case. Just a short word on a quasi-parallel case, but still with electron and proton plasma. And in that case, in this region, we see that vibrant instability can dominate, but still here, Wiesler dominates the transition. And it doesn't mean that when Wiesler dominates over Wiesler, while it doesn't mean that Wiesler resonance do not play any role. It depends on the nonlinear evolution of these instabilities. Maybe the Wiesler wave are growing faster, but has not any significant effect on the structure of the problem. So it has need to be analyzed carefully, even with detailed peak simulation to see the role of the various mode excited in this situation. We have also some range of possible Bell development, Bell instability, by and calculate for relativistic shocks. So it could be dominated by Weibel or by Wiesler waves. And actually, yeah, no, not yet. I will tell it later. No, this wasn't subliminal. No, in superluminal, no. In superluminal, we have another proposition, different, inspired by Bellevue, but a different regime, with not with incompressible waves, but with compressive waves. So in case of an electron-positron plasma, you have no Wiesler. Wiesler waves exist only because you have a contrast of mass between electron and protons. Somehow you have an interesting regime where the proton are too very inert, and electrons are still very light. And this in this intermediate region, you have this peculiar wave, interesting wave that are Wiesler's. You have also low hybrid waves in when you have a mass contrast, but all these type of waves disappear in electron-positron plasma. And so you have mostly Weibel instability and oblique-to-stream instability. Oblique-to-stream instability tend to be disregarded, but it turns out to be very important in this game. This is the similar than the usual two-stream instability, but the most important excited modes are oblique with respect to the beam. But still, it requires to be excited very low magnetization because below that critical value. Well, it turns out again that the oscillating two-stream instability is dominant in this subliminal configuration. It requires only sigma to be below a critical value, which is much larger than that one. Anyway, probably the question is what is the role of this instability? I will discuss that in the next slide. And you have a limitation of Weibel instability due to the magnetization. Weibel instability are quenched if the particles are magnetized in the ambient medium. If we compare with Lorenzo and Anatoly with simulation result, they found a transition 4.1, I think, for magnetization of 0.1, but it corresponds for us to a magnetization of 0.05 gamma S squared. At the critical value. Yeah. Yeah, but this is an order of magnitude of magnetization estimate. But in this, for this estimate, we found that both oscillating two-stream and Weibel instability are quenched when the magnetization is larger than that. So it seems that only your ordinary two-stream instability can develop when the magnetization is so high. I think there are other instabilities that are also interesting when we'll study all the detail of the collisionless shock structure. You have a secondary instability, a resonant one, which is the excitation of ordinary mode. Both ionic and electronic, I dare to say that because many people are familiar with plasma physics in the audience. Otherwise, in plasma, in the pure astrophysics community, I would not pronounce these words. And when you have an extended precursor, because you have already sufficiently triggered the turbulence, you can also have Bell instability. And the compressive instability, which is the alternative of Bell instability for a transverse field, and consider that the shock front is charged, and you have a return current also in the ambient medium, but transverse to the magnetic field. It generates another type of instability, which is of compressive nature, that we found last year with our colleague also, Alexander Markovic. It's interesting to mention that we can also trigger alpha N waves through these quasi-Cherenkov resonance. It's completely unusual. Now, this will depend on the nonlinear process to say whether what are the most important modes. It's not necessarily the fastest growing mode. If there are some nonlinear process that governs saturation, maybe a slower growing instability will generate with time a much higher level of turbulence and might have a more significant structural effect on the shock. Supraluminal, yeah. Yeah, but there are oblique. There's some component of the wave number of the wave vector that are in resonance with the flow of the beam, and a transverse component along the mean field. And the wave propagates obliquely, but the group velocity is still along the mean field. Yeah. Hmm. So, if you look at the nature and the role of the micro instabilities, of course, Weibel and Whistler modes are interesting because they are low phase velocity electromagnetic. The electromagnetic component of the waves is highly dominant and is very suitable for scattering. And the quasi-Cherenkov resonance with Whistler allow scattering of any kind of particles, electron, proton, or whatever their energy, which is not the case of ordinary interaction between particles and Whistler waves. It selects only because it's a right-handed polarized waves, so it can resonate only with electrons, and the electrons having some specific energy to allow resonance. Because synchrotron resonance. But with the quasi-Cherenkov resonance, we have not this selection effect. So oblique two-stream modes are mostly electrostatic with a 20% of electromagnetic component. They produce scattering anyway, but also some energy transfer at the same rate than scattering, more or less. So what produce in the shock structure? It contributes to heat, certainly, at the same time that it scatter. And the extraordinary mode I mentioned are excited mostly on the electrostatic component. And the long wavelength approximation turns out to be a match with the ionic branch with the MHD compressive instability we developed last year. Actually, we found last year that this instability was growing. The fastest growing mode was not in the MHD regime, but in the kinetic regime. And it turns out to be an extraordinary mode. And I think that like in non-relativistic shocks, these extraordinary modes, like the hybrid modes, for instance, participate to the heating process of the foot region, but mostly the protons. But I don't exclude some amount of electron heating due to these waves also. Now, an interesting point about the resonant modes, they are propagating forwards because the selection of resonance select waves that are propagating in the direction of the beam, so forwards. Anyway, there is a frequency shift due to the interaction of these waves with the beam that that shift the frequency, it's a red shift due to this interaction. So they have a phase velocity smaller than the velocity of the front shock front. So all these instability are transmitted downstream. This is an important point. Now I will conclude the provisory conclusion. My main conclusion is postponed for the conference. there's a major problem in this development. I have no answer yet, the definite answer, is how these modes excited upstream are converted into modes downstream. Because the nature of the plasma changed downstream. Upstream, even if you start with an electron-proton plasma and you have Wiesler excitation, downstream, there's no clear answer now about the electron temperature, but you have electron and proton that have relativistic temperature of order gamma s and proton c square, so they behave like a pair plasma somehow, with no mass contrast. And so there's no Wiesler Noether brain mode. So what these modes become, these modes, Wiesler and hybrid that has been excited upstream, how they behave downstream when they are transmitted downstream. Actually, I have not a final answer about that because I have not finished the detailed calculation, but there is a possibility of continuous conversion of upstream Wiesler to downstream right Alphen modes. You know that all the Alphen modes can be split into right-handed and left-handed. The left-handed are absorbed by proton-cyclotron resonances. And the left continues at the electron scale in the form of Wiesler waves. So there is a continuity between the Wiesler waves and right Alphen waves. And I think that most of the Wiesler mode excited upstream are converted into right Alphen waves downstream. And this would be also interesting for another point of view, that you have in these shock means that you have generated helicity. And you know that helicity is always very interesting to generate dynamo action. Both. This is the... That's right. We can directly excite Alphen wave, yeah. So it's mostly a problem, it's mostly important for superluminal shocks, yeah. Okay, that's analytical investigation. Now it has to be confronted to peak simulation, of course, yes, and maybe we have to revise some hope, but... So more detailed conference during more detailed conclusion during the conference, if you don't mind. Thank you. Hola. It's possible, yeah, of course, you can couple Alphen and Wiesler modes, and it's interesting. You can have two Wiesler modes coupled with long Alphen modes, for instance. And I have no... I think that to get micro turbulence from large-scale turbulence, you need to have already generate some small-scale turbulence. Then you can make important energy transfer directly from large-scale to small-scale. Otherwise, if you excite also both small-scale wave, you can generate also large-scale wave by mode coupling. But you have not direct generation of small-scale turbulence from large-scale. It's impossible from kinematic conditions. It can be, it's sublama, yeah. With the you can couple these rather short scale magnetic compressive fluctuation with the large scale alpha modes and generates intense, probably intense short scale modes. It's an interesting investigation. But I think that superluminal non-relativistic shock are not so easy to analyze. It's easy, the structure of the shock is easy to more easy to calculate. But excitation of instabilities in these superluminal configuration, even non-relativistic, are not so easy because you have all these twisted beams and actually Whistler waves, hybrid waves are excited in these non-relativistic superluminal shocks. It has been observed directly. I don't know whether maybe Don has the answer. If there is some cutoff in the distribution of superthermal relativistic electrons in transverse in superluminal shock, and that could be intrinsic to the process, not due to. We have a cutoff that depends on the shock gamma to the square. So we could, but it turns out that, as I will emphasize during the conference, it's good for electrons, but protons will not have a lot of energy gained by Fermi process when if it works. They are energized to energy which is more larger than their mass energy due to these, I would say, a relativistic barrier for them. And because they are accelerated at energy comparable to the energy of protons. And so it's a strong gap, a strong increase for the energy of electrons. But then protons can gain also some amount of energy, but not a lot. There are anyway some, due to the structure of the shock itself, there is necessarily some sizable fraction of proton that are accelerated anyway, but not necessary to very high energy, unfortunately.
Thank you. Obviously this is not working properly.